Carol Demas, the original Sandy of Broadway's Grease, and Carol of Carol and Paula in the Magic Garden, which became the most successful regional children's show in television history. And I'm talking to Dave Lefkowitz on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on this very Alan Sherman-esque episode of the show. We've had Mark Cohen, of course, talking about his book Overweight Sensation about Alan Sherman. And wonderfully enough, I got an email from an actress and singer who has been on this program before, about 2 years ago, the lovely and talented Carol Demas. You might know her from the original Grease and the Fantastics, and she was on TV's The Magic Garden for us East Coasters a few years back. Anyway, Carol was on the show. Was wonderful to talk to her about a bunch of stuff months and months ago. She learned that we are doing this show about Alan Sherman, mainly, and she said, oh my gosh, I have an Alan Sherman story. I met him a couple of times. I didn't know him very well. She possibly could have known him very well, as Carol will explain. Carol is on the phone with us now. Welcome, first of all, Carol. How are you?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you again. Hi.
Hi. Actually, you're not that good. You're wearing a boot these days. What happened to you?
It's sort of very Darth Vader.
What did you do to yourself?
It's one of those boots that's used for a variety of things, where your foot or your ankle or that, you know, part of your body is involved, to sort of keep it in a certain position and help the blood flow and whatever. I have Achilles tendinosis, which my current agent says sounds like one of my former Greek relatives.
Anyway. And what is the difference between tendinitis and tendinosis?
It's just that osis is worse.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
The inflammation, and osis is when you reach a point where you have some scar tissue.
Oh.
The tendons thickening up and scarring and whatever, and you hope that you can escape surgery with various exercises and stretches and warmth and this boot thing.
Yeah.
So you put something in another shoe to try to raise it up a little bit, and then you go clunking around.
Well, that's the thing. You're telling me that you at least are, you're not like chair bound or couch, but you're clumping around, you're cleaning the garage. When do you think you'll be able to perform, you know, and do your cabaret stuff?
I don't know. It all depends on whether or not we have to head for surgery or not.
Oh, right.
That will take some time. But if we don't, the good thing about the boot is that I can take it off.
Oh.
I could get up on stage. It's not like a cast, you know, where you're stuck. I could get up on stage and I don't think that I would be ready to do a whole show of my own and be on my feet without it for an hour or longer, but to do a few numbers. And I have been asked to join some of the kinds of shows that go on in New York that are repeated weekly or repeated monthly.
Mm.
Various hosts have these in various of the venues, and so doing some of those in the fall. But in the meantime, I had to get some junk out of the garage, and I had help. So I think I stood on this foot a little too long because we got fired up and going. But my husband always laughs because my friend Paula had someone who worked for her on her gardens and whatever. And when she was doing some construction and various shrubs need to be moved out of the way, I was over there, you know, digging up things to bring and keep them here for her.
Yeah.
Her gardener friend declared to my husband, "Your wife is an animal."
Well, interesting.
Well, there you have it. I was in animal phase in the garage today.
Well, okay, yeah, that's
interesting. The glamorous life we lead here.
In and out of context, let me tell you. Speaking of someone who, how I segue into this, into the animal mode. Someone who would have liked to have been an animal with you. Oh, God. Oh, I try. I try. It would be, of course, the person that we're talking about, Alan Sherman. And as I said, you were kind enough. You got the email, the Dave mail that we send out every week about the show. You saw that we're talking about this biography of Alan Sherman. And you got to meet him because...
I got to meet him because he was writing and getting near the end of that process and you know, being ready, looking forward to the show coming to Broadway. He was writing a show called The Fig Leaves Are Falling. This was in the late 60s, and he was doing lyrics, and I think he did the book, too. He was writing it with Albert Haig, who wrote Plain and Fancy, among other things, and Redhead.
And people might best know Albert Haig playing that old lovable teacher in the TV show Fame.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He was a really sweet man. And I got this call from my agent, and he said, you know, they are interested in you, so we're going to see what happens. Apparently, he saw you somewhere. Alan saw you, saw your work, knows your work, thinks you're very right for the part of the young lead, young female lead, and he's kind of excited, so we'll see what happens. And the next thing you know, I got a call at home from Alan himself.
Oh.
And he said, I know your agent has probably told you about this, and I would be interested in meeting you personally, and I would, you know, like for us to get to know each other a little, so can I take you out to dinner? And I said, well, I need to check on a couple of things. Can I call you back? Because immediately I called my agent, and I said,
this is a real deal here.
Should I go? What do you think will be expected of me? He said, you're a big girl. I think you can handle this. He said, I think you can keep it all on a professional and friendly level. And yes, go, because this is real interest. And if you get in trouble, you know, you can call me. I'll come and save you. So anyway, we decided that, yes, I would go, and I accepted the invitation. And then in the meantime, I started wondering, what if it does get a little complicated? You know, this is so different from Hollywood. You hear about the casting couch all the time and whatever, but in New York, it's kind of a different story. And the theater's kind of different. Not always, but, you know.
And let me break in, though, and say, as you know, I discussed with Mark Cohen, there was this other side. Alan Sherman was a tremendously sweet and friendly guy and great to his friends, but he had, it isn't even a darker side necessarily, but he was in the midst of sampling all the wares of the 1960s revolution, which is sex and drugs and rock and roll. He ain't rock and roll, but the other stuff, he was dipping not just a toe into, but, you know, feet bootless and all, into all of it. And so he was out there in kind of a big way. So just bringing that out there, as you had some reason to be somewhat concerned about his motivations. Okay.
Yes, continue. Although yeah. I didn't know quite as much about all of that as you know now, and as I know now, because you've told me.
Right.
And maybe it's just that I didn't. So it was set up that he would come and he would pick me up and we would go out to dinner. So I called my dearest friend in all the world, Paula Janis, with whom I appeared on The Magic Garden, but we'd actually been friends since we were 14 years old. And I said, I don't know where this is going, and just in case it's not really comfortable and I don't know what to do, let's make a plan that you will call me during dinner, as soon as I know where we're going, when he gets here, I'll just make a quick phone call and let you know where, and you can call me there, so that I can let you know if I think I really need to come back from the phone and offer an excuse for it not to be a late evening, in case that's where it looks like it's going. And she said, "Oh, fine, you know, we'll do that." All right, so here comes Alan, and he comes to my apartment, and I find out that we are going to
It was a very popular
hideaway.
Danny's Hideaway.
Danny's Hideaway, right. Which is a place that was made famous because Frank Sinatra was very fond of it. So I had never been there, and I thought, well, this should be interesting. But then, as I'm getting ready to say, I just have to run and make this phone call, he presents me with a big box that says, I brought you something. And I want you to open it now. Okay.
Yeah.
This is nice, I think. And I opened it, and it was a dress. A dress.
Yeah, a women's dress.
Oh, yes, which a little unusual, especially from someone that you barely know.
And the weird part is, this was not a dress that your character would have worn in the musical. It wasn't like he was testing you to see what you would look like in characters.
No, not necessarily. It was a personal gift, and the dress actually was something that was very right for me. It was really very pretty and kind of sexy. It was sort of flower child bear, a print, sort of an African type print. Lovely colors, very good colors for me.
I'm actually wearing a dress like that right now.
Oh, are you?
I am indeed, yeah.
Mine was a sundress. Is yours?
Yeah, it's actually a sun and snow dress because I wear it 365.
Oh, I'm so sorry I can't see it from here.
No, because I never wash it. You really don't want to. It was nice when I first got it, but now. Anyway, I'm sorry. I interrupted.
Okay, anyway, where were we? So I said, well, this is just lovely. He said, I'd really like you to wear it. I said, now?
And he said, yes.
Yes. Well, I'd like you to wear it to dinner. So I thought, okay. He said, you look very nice, but I'd like you to wear this dress. So I said, okay, just give me a minute, you know, and I'll go put it on. And I was hoping that if it really was quite as bare as it looked, that maybe it wouldn't fit. But it did fit, and it actually was very, very pretty and kind of hot. And I had a minute to call Paula and say, well, you're not going to believe it, but blah, 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 dress. So you really better call me at Danny's Hideaway because I don't know what's going to happen next. So we went out to the curb, and there was this lovely limo waiting. And Alan and I got in the back, and we went to Danny's Hideaway. And I was a little worried about him because it was the first time that I'd actually met him, and he seemed to be not in the best of health. He was on the heavy side, and he seemed to run out of breath easily. And it just, you know, it was just something that I noticed, and I thought, gee, I really hope he's all right. So we got there, and Danny's Hideaway turned out to be a place that was very nice if you really wanted to be able to talk to someone, because it was not especially noisy, and there were these big, comfy sort of half-round banquettes, which we worked our way into and sat down. And we started having dinner. And at one point he said something to me like, you know, I really hope you'll have time to come to my apartment. And let's have a drink afterwards and talk about the show. And I can't talk about the show.
Yeah.
So
falling fig leaves indeed.
Paul came. God bless Paula.
Right, she called you at the restaurant.
Arrived at the table, right, and he said, Miss Demas, there's a call for you. And I said, oh, thank you, and started to get up, figuring, you know, the phone was some distance where I was going to be able to have a couple private minutes with Paula and come back and explain that the late night discussion probably wasn't on the menu tonight.
Right.
But that's not how it worked at Danny's Hideaway. One must remember that this was 1968 or 9, I can't remember exactly, and we had no cell phones at that time, and what was very unusual was that at Danny's Hideaway, if you had a call, you did not have to leave your seat because they brought you a telephone, a big clunky telephone, and plugged it into an extension, you know, right there.
Right.
And so I was having to have my conversation at Alan's side. So I said, well, hello, Paula, how are you? Oh, that's right, that's how you knew I was here. I'm trying to, you know. And I said, is everything okay? You should see this. I said, they brought the phone right to me. I'm sitting right next to Alan right now. So
smart,
got
yeah.
Victor. I got through the phone call and then explained to him that Paula was having a problem, and she really would deeply appreciate it if I would come by after dinner, so I hope that he would understand, and we proceeded to go on with our evening.
Right, okay.
A little disappointed, but, you know, he
was a gentleman. He was
gentleman.
Fine, yeah.
He was. So, as the evening went on, we talked about the show some and whatever, and then at one point, because it was an extremely hot day, as I remember, and I had drunk all of my water, and the water had come to the table in the biggest goblets that I've ever seen served in a restaurant. Actually, me. It was very beautiful because it was an enormous bowl with lovely miniature ice cubes, lots of them, glistening in this enormous bowl on a long, thin stem. So I had drunk all my water, and I said I'd really like to get some more water. And Alan said, I haven't touched mine here. Take mine. And he reached over and put his fingers, you know, around the bowl. And he was still looking at me as he handed it to me. He wasn't looking at the glass. This is important, Steve.
Okay.
What he didn't notice, and I didn't either, at least not in time, was that the bowl had separated from that lovely, graceful, long stem right at the point where they meet.
Yeah.
So the stem was still sitting in front of Alan at the bowl.
Which now had a hole at the bottom of it, right? Or
no, it didn't.
Oh.
It didn't. It just cracked right beneath the bowl, right where they meet. So he set the bowl down, and it obviously couldn't stand up because it had no.
Oh, it was
footing.
It would topple. Yeah.
So it toppled over on to me. It's an absolute, you know, bathtub full. Freezing cold water and ice cubes. Down inside the dress, all over the dress. I was soaked and cold.
And cold, right.
Cold. And he was just absolutely mortified. He, as funny as he can be and as quick as he can be, he was really wiped out by this. He kind of didn't know what to say, and neither did I, except that I think maybe the best thing, since we've had some time together, would be for me to go home and dry off and warm up and go see what it is that
Paula needs. Don't forget you have to get to Paula.
Yes. So I can't remember. I think maybe the restaurant gave us a tablecloth or some towels or something, you know, so that I wouldn't be getting into the back of this air-conditioned limousine soaking wet. Thank God the dress wasn't transparent when wet. This was not the wet t-shirt kind of thing. So the whole thing could have been even worse.
Not for Alan, but okay, but for you.
Well, I got home, and he did call me a few more times and asked me, you know, if we could talk and if I could come over, and each time I let my agent know that this had happened and asked him whether he thought we were still on the right track here, and he approved, and I went. The first time there was another person there, a woman, who disappeared rather quickly, and we were sitting on chairs at first, and then he suggested that the couch was much more comfortable, and you know, that was
right.
It was a big couch.
Okay.
Plenty of room for both of us, but it was very clear that while I was flattered that he seemed to think a great deal of my talent and the work that he had seen me do, and he had honestly really had, that he had a personal interest in me, that he was attracted to me.
Right.
And I really liked him, actually. He was a nice guy, and he was funny and fun, but I was not
right.
attracted to him. I was not physically attracted to him. And so I really didn't want to encourage him. I didn't think that was fair. And it's kind of a funny position to be in when you know that there's a possibility that you could end up playing this fantastic role in a new Broadway show with Albert Haig's music. And all of that was, you know, sounded very good to me.
Right.
What if, you know, it got really complicated and messy? I just had to think that maybe I'll deal with that down the road. Fortunately, nothing happened in those few meetings.
Right, and you also had the wherewithal. Actually, I'm surprised neither of us thought of this at first, of just saying, you know, I am engaged.
Well, actually, at one point, I said to him, I think it would be only right for me to tell you that I have someone in my life. And he said, oh.
Okay, well, yeah, all right. But that hopefully took, you know, some of the steam out of his engine, as it were.
Yes. I mean, I wasn't living with anyone at the moment. And, you know, there wasn't any gossip about me being about with this person. Actually, there was someone.
Okay.
But it was a complicated situation, which, you know, is neither here nor there in terms of this conversation. But I was so grateful that I was able to say that.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing that kind of caps the story is that, yes, I'm sure Alan was personally interested in you, but he was also seemingly really interested in you for that part, a part that he wrote and that he knew, and yet he was overruled, ultimately, by...
by George Abbott.
The director.
Yes, who had a slightly different idea about this character. And so it ended up going to Jenny O'Hara. And every once in a while I thought to myself, gee, I wonder if maybe this was actually the case, has been the case for a while, and Alan just didn't tell me. You know, you just don't know in these situations what the real story is.
Or vice versa. It could have been like, you know, as soon as you finally made it really 100% clear that nothing was going to happen, you know, Alan went to George Abbott and said, yeah, get Jenny O'Hara. It's okay.
Well, I'll never know that. And I never had the opportunity to ask him. And even if I had, I don't think I would have.
Actually, Jenny O'Hara was on our show a couple of years ago. I should probably get you to talk to her and see what her side of it is.
See, that would be interesting, wouldn't it? Except that, of course, there is a rehearsal stretch of time. So, and people get to know each other pretty well in that time, because it's very intense.
Sure.
And it's a lot of hours being close to everyone involved, and your life is on the line for a while. So she might have gotten to know him quite well. Maybe, I don't know, I haven't read the book. I don't know whether there's anything in it, that...
Yeah, it's my one, few criticisms I have of Mark Cohen's book is that he doesn't really spend a lot of time and pages on Fig Leaves Are Falling. He makes it sound like something kind of minor towards the end of his life, rather than, what could have been a big Broadway show. It turned out to be a flop. It ran four nights. Anything that happened after the Warner Brothers record albums is almost seen as a very negligible thing, which I don't necessarily see. I mean, he probably put as much work into the Broadway musical and then into his last book as he did into any of the Warner Brothers albums that sold a zillion copies.
That's a big dream. And I actually, in the course of all of this, did learn a few of the songs because I worked with Albert Haig on them, because they wanted me to come in and sing them. So, I mean, I guess there was some reality going on here, and Albert was a lovely man and just happened to be a dear friend of my voice teacher mentor, Felix Knight. And I don't even know if Albert, when I look back on it, may have had something to do with trying to...
Oh, to make you be the...
Help me along in this quest for the role. But there's so much stuff that goes on Broadway behind the scenes.
Well, yeah.
That it's really mind-blowing.
And actually, as the capper to this story, do you still ever do a song or two from The Fig Leaves Are Falling in your cabaret work? Do you sing them anywhere?
No, I don't.
Okay.
But in fact, I only started thinking about them again just a day or two ago because I'd spoken to you, because I just started thinking about Alan and Albert,
sure.
And I thought, maybe I should just look at those and see. And then I Googled the show and was very surprised to see that it played recently in a small off-Broadway production. I didn't even catch that. I don't know where I was at the time. I don't know how it fared or whether it was well thought of. I do remember seeing something, it may have been an old review, it may have been a new one, regarding difficulties with the story.
Well, they didn't like the story back in 1969 either. Even then, the critics were carping about the whole the sexism is sexism of it, and it was also sort of old fashioned in a weird way. You know, it tried to have it both ways. It tried to be very kind of modern and free and swinging, and then at the same time have it really be conservative and puritanical on another level. But they said there were some really good songs if you plucked them out, and I think that was the reviews. For the new version as well, for, I shouldn't say the new, the rival.
In the original show, I have to say, and you know, and all of them had big, big careers. And Dorothy got a Tony nomination.
That's right, Dorothy Loudon was in the...
Yes, and it's always sort of sad to realize that someone is that good in something enough to get a nomination like that, and then it only runs for 4 nights. So how does anybody who's going to try and vote on it get to see it? I mean, it's over before the nominations even come out. So,
well, that's the nature of the game.
Yes,
even now.
It's true. I just did something at Town Hall in which Carolee Carmello sang, and she got a Tony nomination this year. God, she's lovely. What a nice person she is.
And she's had a run of bad luck, though. She had Scandalous.
But
she's had a couple in a row.
Got a Tony nomination, again, for something that didn't run long enough for everyone to see how great she was in it. I didn't see her in it. But we shared a dressing room at the Town Hall in New York City just a few months ago in one of those Broadway by the Year.
Oh, yeah, Scott Siegel.
And yeah. They do there, yes. And Scott asked me to come and sing something from Greece because the year was 1972. And that was great fun. And Scott's really fun. You know, those things get put together so fast. It's just a whirlwind. It's totally madness.
But he's been doing them for so long that I think he knows how to put it together like clockwork. I mean, I've known Scott before he was doing them when he was a theater critic. So, you know, I know his mind, and I can totally tell that his energy and his heart just slam those things together, but they work great.
He knows Broadway probably as well as anybody out there, and maybe better. He really does. And, you know, he had a series running at Feinstein's at the Regency.
Oh, yeah.
A late night one called Broadway Ballyhoo. And it was doing very well. And my musical director, Ian Herman, and friend of, you know, since the late 70s, I mean, we worked together all the time, was playing for it. And what a shame that Feinstein's is gone. The corporate world killed Feinstein's.
Well, Feinstein's was also, I think, I mean, I went there a couple of times. It was lovely, but as a critic, I couldn't have afforded to. I think they priced themselves out of the market for what they were. You know,
well, it was expensive.
Yeah.
It was expensive. Elegant and you know, very nice, very pretty place. And if you ever saw them put it away at night when the show was done, you would really be stunned. A couple of guys move in and suddenly it's all gone, and the room turns back.
It's just a room, you know. And you take away the tablecloths, the candles, the lighting,
the platform, the piano rolls out, and it's just gone.
And speaking of gone, I hate to sort of end the thing on this, but have you heard the news about the press agent who was repping Feinstein's, whom you probably knew or met? Do you know Miller Wright?
No.
He worked with Shirley Herz, whom I'm sure you probably have heard of. Sure, he was one of the people working under Shirley for many years.
Uh-huh.
And then he went off on his own and did some shows and a lot of off-Broadway stuff, and he was the press rep for Feinstein's at the Regency for all its years, basically. And then just earlier this week or last week, he has this very nice apartment up on 23rd Street in Manhattan. Oh, no, excuse me. It's an apartment in Manhattan on the 23rd floor, and that's actually quite germane. Because he liked to keep his windows really, really clean. And, well, you know, nobody knows. He was either cleaning his windows and had an accident, or things have not been great client-wise for him, and he fell.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and he died last week. So that was a bit of a... I don't know why I'm telling you, but a bit of a shock for me and for everybody who knew him for all these years.
That is... we never know, do we? But on a slightly more positive... I will tell you that Scott Siegel and Barb, his wife, who is wonderful, have, you know, hunted around for a new home for Broadway Ballyhoo, and they looked at a number of venues and decided to take it to the Beachman.
Oh, of course, right.
Lori Beachman.
Yeah.
At the West Bank Cafe, which is on West 42nd Street near 9th Avenue, so it's not far from most of the theaters in the theater district, and, you know, they serve late there and whatever, so Wednesday nights, now Broadway Ballyhoo will be there, and I heard from Scott, and he'd like me to come and sing for him.
Sure.
So I said, as soon as I can on 2 feet without embarrassing you, I would be happy to be there. So I'll probably be singing there either next month or in September.
Or, well, hey, if they can get you a nice comfy stool, do it next month, you know?
There we go.
Well, Carol Demas, again, it has been an absolute delight to hear your stories, to hear your memories, to hear you talk about folks, and it will be a delight for people to go and see you once you're back on both feet, bootless, singing and doing cabaret. And just want to wish you good health, first of all, more than anything else, but luck and creativity and more music.
Well, thank you. You know, a life without music would be unthinkable. And it's people like you who help the rest of us to keep going and let us share what we do in a different way. And I appreciate it very much. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Carol.